As Buddy Green, fall down, children, worship the Lord. It's 12 and a half after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and that can only mean one thing. Dr. Don Clark is joining us here. Don from Garden Valley, Texas. That's where he works a vineyard these days and does biochemistry things, because by trade he's a biochem. Well, I guess by trade now you're a vintner, aren't you? A vineyard.
I'm a vintner, yes.
Yeah,
and a vineyard.
So then biochemistry is an avocation? Do you still dabble in it? I know you were in it for years with pharmaceuticals and elsewhere. You were trained as a scientist, but do you still dabble in? What are you a member of a society of biochemists? Are there such things?
Well, yes, there was.
No,
but I'm not a member anymore, because whenever you join a society like that, of course there's annual fees that you have to pay.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're not actively working in the field, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because you're not going to be going to the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the type of meetings we go to now are winemaking and vineyard care type meetings, with the mm-hmm. Texas Grape Growers Association.
That would be TGGA would be the Texas Grape Growers Association.
Yes.
Okay.
I imagine this is the time of the year when there's a lot of meetings going on, huh?
Well, it is, because when the grapes start growing, when they wake up from their winter's slumber, it's all hands on deck, so you don't have time to go vacation and do a conference somewhere.
Do you ever feel like you stepped out of the frying pan into the fire? I mean, here you are, a nice biochemist with a white lab coat, and you get to walk around and give lectures and stuff. And now you have to work with your hands, and you get dirt under your fingernails, and you have to carry heavy things back and forth and stomp on those grapes. Was it a good trade?
It's fun. Hmm. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. Okay. I mean, it's art. It's definitely hard work. I'm not working behind a desk so much, other than from the accounting and
running a business too.
Design work, it's more walking around, which is a good thing to do, especially the older you get. I don't have quite the energy I used to when I was younger.
No, I know how that works. Yeah,
but it's fun. I like a challenge, and there's always a challenge in this. So.
Dr. Don, also a member of the board of Creation Moments, and he comes to us each Tuesday, and we talk about things scientific, and we talk about faith, and we talk about creation, and we talk about evolution. And in the case of this morning, this is something called fast evolution, and it has to do with epigenetics. Can you explain what epigenetics are, or is?
Well, I'll go the technical route, and then
I'll brace myself then. Okay.
What causes it? So, epigenetics is actually a modification to the DNA, the sugars, actually. So the backbone of a DNA is a phosphate sugar backbone. For any of those who have had biochemistry in their biology classes, for example. And it's a methylation of one of the sugar hydroxyl groups. But the question is, what causes that, and why does that take place? Well, it's in response to the organism's environment. And it apparently causes genes to be turned on or turned off depending on what the organism is going through. For example, if we have a lot of fear in our lives, then we can actually pass that fear on through our modified DNA backbone to our progeny, to our children.
What could that mean for future Democrats then?
Oh, they're going to be living in a tremendous amount of fear.
Yeah, I didn't mean
as their generations.
didn't mean to sidetrack you there, but I had to make that.
No, I get into politics, then we got another discussion altogether.
Yeah, that's true.
So, in essence, it's a organisms have the capability built in them from their creation, from the Creator God, of modifying their DNA and modifying the expression of their DNA, as especially the you know, the codon, the one that's the those parts of the gene that actually express proteins, and they can express different proteins depending on their environment.
And what do we see? What difference does that make? How does that affect the organism, this change in DNA sugars? You know, what becomes apparent to us so that we know that that's going on?
Well, we can certainly analyze for it, you know, from a biochemistry point mm-hmm. of view, from a biochemical point of view. That's not a problem, but and we can see on the macro level changes. For example, you would have might have an have a an animal that is used to certain type of environment, and the environment changes, and they then express you know, a different trait based on the environment they're in. Mm-hmm. Now, a perfect example of this might be, for example, the Darwinian finches.
Uh-huh.
That Darwin, you know, we know, visited the Galapagos Islands. He was a naturalist on the HMS Beagle. He was hired to basically record the different types of animals that they found, and they came up to the Galapagos Islands, and lo and behold, they looked like this was a prehistoric place. And so he made tons of sketches, and one of them happened to be the series of finches that he saw there. And on some of the islands, the finches had small beaks. On some of the islands, the finches had large beaks. And he concluded that, voila, you see, we've got evidence of evolution taking place. Of course, that was some time later when he started looking through his material, and then came up with this idea of evolution. And so he used the finch example as an example of how the environment can pressure a particular organism to change. Now, the problem with what he was observing is that the finches, let's say with the large beaks that typically crack seeds on the ground, versus the finches that had small beaks, which took the softer seeds from the plants, was the environment was, if the environment was dry, then the finches developed large beaks because the seeds fell on the ground. And then after several seasons, of course, if it was dry, then the only seeds available were the dry fruit, if you will, mm-hmm. that was on the ground. And so out of the pressure of the environment, the finches developed large beaks. If the area got wet again, then the population of finches shifted back to the small-beaked finches. And so you had this shift going back and forth as the environment changed. Well, Darwin wasn't on the island long enough to observe the change, you know, back in the population. He just observed these two different or several different types of finches, and there were finches with intermediate beaks, and he says, voila. So that was an example of a bird, in this case the finch, responding to its environment and changing its morphology slightly in order to better equip itself, if you will, to finding the food it needed, you know, to survive. Now, one could say that the gene for whether small beaks or large beaks was already programmed into the finch, and it's just being expressed based on the pressure of the environment. On the other hand, the evolutionists would say, well, no, the finch actually developed new genetic material, and to produce, you know, one size beak over the other.
And we would maintain these are different species.
And would maintain they
the evolutionists would, yeah. You know,
Right. And just as, but a different species or subspecies, if you will, because they're both finches, does not, just because you call it different, in quotes, doesn't mean that it's actually different or that the DNA is radically different. Mm-hmm. And you've got a new organism. See, that's the trick that evolutionists like to play. And biologists, for that matter, they start calling different species because, aha, you see, we got a little one of these creatures over here that we found in the in some river, and it's not found anywhere else, but we've got bigger ones other places, so we're going to call this a different species. And oh, lo and behold, we have to protect this river because we got these little fishes in there as opposed to the mm-hmm. bigger ones somewhere in Africa.
So you're saying the method of classification itself induces or can induce error?
Well, it can induce a misinterpretation of what's being uh-huh. seen.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the pre-assumptions, that is the assumption of evolution, which says that, hey, these changes inherently are slow and take the eons of time to happen, and what we're actually seeing is the result of, thousands and thousands, millions upon millions of years of, in quote, evolution, where, in fact, if you took the big fish and you put him in the small river, that the offspring of the big fish, it wouldn't take long for them to be producing smaller fish.
Maybe a generation or two or three, perhaps.
Right, exactly.
Now, I've got another question for you, and I'm asking if this has to do with epigenetics also and what someone might call fast evolution. We know that, for example, if a person becomes blind, their other senses often seem to sharpen, to expand, and provide more in-depth service to them in terms of getting around and hearing and its taste and its feel. Is that the same thing? Is that a DNA change, do you suppose? Has there been research on that?
I don't know if there's been any research on that. I mean, it's kind of logical that you would, if you didn't have the use of your eyes and your brain had to concentrate more on the hearing and touch,
mm-hmm.
For example, and even temperature variations, in your fingers and skin and mm-hmm. things, it wouldn't take you long to become more attuned to those things because you don't have the distraction of your eyes anymore. So I'm not necessarily, I don't know if epigenetics or modification in the DNA is involved in that process, but it seems like one could make a general kind of assumption that what you think is what happens to your DNA. Mm-hmm. In other words, there is some type of electrical connection or electrical stimulation from the brain, especially if it has to do with emotions, seems to translate into a chemical modification of the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know now, for example, that if you have a person who's living their life in peace, then their children are more likely to at least start off in life living a peaceful life and not being afraid of their environment.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said earlier, if you have a person who's full of fear and jumps at the least bit little noise, then their progeny is more likely mm-hmm. to do the same thing.
And I ask this just to kind of help me determine and help listeners determine what might prompt a change in DNA. And we're talking about environmental changes here. Let's say you have a pack of wolves in a moderate climate that for some reason has several years of extreme cold. Would their coats not grow thicker then during the winter in response? Or would they die off?
Oh, no, they would. You see, that's the thing. I mean, God has built in to every organism that lives, that is on this earth, the ability to modify, you know, to grow, let's say, a sub, you know, sub fur, if you will, over the big, the longer fur that would be. And you see it in dogs. I mean, we see this in dogs. I mean, you take a dog, when it starts getting, you know, colder, they'll start growing this fluffy, softer undercoat that, you know, that keeps them warm. It's like, you know, putting on us putting on a, you know, fur coat. They've got an extra layer of fur there.
What could what could explain that change other than a change in DNA?
It is a change in expression of certain genes. You know, a gene that would say, okay, grow the softer fur, for example, the undercoat. In response to a temperature change, you know, the temperature sensors, if you will, in their skin, for example, would then induce this type of change. Is it, you know, in the DNA? Well, it's certainly in the expression of the DNA. How that plays out, is there something in the blood, for example, that triggers this? I don't know what the mechanism is. Somebody probably has studied it to try to figure it out. But it is an interesting, you know, an interesting observation that, hey, this is what happens, you know, to these creatures, to these animals. It's not just, you know, dogs or wolves or foxes or, you know, any of those things. I mean, you see it with other types of animals as well. I mean, bears and you know, moose and, you know, that live in colder climates, they will develop this undercoat too, that helps them stay warm during very, very cold, very cold climate. Now, the point being, though, that God designed this into them from the beginning. This is not. They all of a sudden acquired new genetic material or new genetic information. The information is there, and it's either being turned on or it's being turned off. So, in the case of a wolf or a dog, it is in the underfur, it's turned on in the cold, and it's turned off when it starts getting hot again to suit the environment that the animal is in.
So and, these are this is DNA doing what it was designed to do to begin with.
Exactly. Exactly. And so to call something, you know, a fast evolution is a play on words and a sleight of hand by the evolutionists to say, aha, you see, evolution does take place faster, even though for years, for hundreds of years, I mean, since Darwin, even Darwin, you know, said that this process is a very slow process. We can't observe the changes, but now we're observing these changes. So obviously, you know, there must be, you know, processes of evolution that take place quickly. And one of the things that they point to is epigenetics as an example. But epigenetics is not new genetic information. It's just a modification to the DNA backbone, which then affects the expression of genes for that organism.
And it's not properly termed evolution at all.
Exactly. It's not. It's a variation within a kind. It is the response of the organism or the animal to its environment. And when the environment changes back to what it was in before, guess what? The animal changes back, whatever the expression was. So, you know, in the example of the wolf in its underfur, you know, is a perfect example of, hey, this happens annually. So obviously it's built into the DNA, has been built into the DNA from the very beginning, and no new information is existing. And then, you know, one of the examples of one organism that the evolutionists like to throw out, and they did this early on, was bacteria resistance to antibiotics, for example. How does that occur? I mean, you design an antibiotic, and you have some bacteria that you've designed it against, and lo and behold, over a period of time, if that particular type of bacteria keeps getting exposed to this antibiotic, we have populations of bacteria that become resistant. How does that happen? Well, I mean, you've got billions of bacteria, and some of those bacteria, for example, have a different or can switch pathways for, let's say, a food substance, or for they can take a poison substance and turn it into an innocuous substance simply because they already have the genetic information in them. And they can pass that genetic information from one bacteria to the next. I mean, that's been shown to occur. And so that the more of that particular type of bacteria is exposed to the antibiotic, the more of those resistant organisms you have. It's not that the bacteria all of a sudden decided, oh, I'm just going to create a new gene. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. You're going to create a new gene that has a DNA segment of hundreds and hundreds of base pairs? And what's the probability of that? Absolutely zero. So that didn't occur. So what we have to step back and say, you know what? That population of bacteria, some of those bacteria already had already were expressing that gene, and they survived.
Now, here's kind of the other side of this coin, and this might be a challenge to deal with. And I'm going to read a paragraph directly from this article at the Institute for Creation Research, and talking about fast evolution and how the standard evolution used to say almost geological times, generation after generation after generation, to impart these changes. Conversely, if the flood decimated air-breathing organisms only about 4,600 years ago, and the ark had limited kinds of animals, then creationists are challenged to explain the huge diversity of life we see today. And creationists theorize that organisms' innate systems enable rapid rates of trait diversification to explain how they continuously fill environmental niches. And then that's an important phrase there, to enable rapid rates of trait diversification. That is the creationist saying epigenetics is genuine. It happens, but it doesn't result in cats coming from dogs or birds coming from dinosaurs. But it does involve trait diversification to fill environmental niches. That says animals rapidly adapting to various ambients.
Well, right. That's right. Because some of those terms in what you read are important aspects, because creationists talk about different kinds of animals. So one of the more famous kinds is the dog species, mm-hmm. or the dog kind. What's in the dog kind? Well, you've got the dog, right? You've got the wolf. And what's the difference between a dog and a wolf? Well, the wolf is a predator and likes to go after rabbits and stuff and packs. Go in packs. Dogs love to be in packs. If you take a dog and the dog is just domesticated, mm-hmm. and we have humans have love our dogs, and you can imagine, and we talked about this on one of our previous shows. It was last, I don't know if it was last year or whatever, but about the rapid domestication of, for example, the dog. I mean, you can take a wild wolf or a wild fox, for example, and the Russians have done this with foxes. You can take a little fox that is kind of friendly to humans, and you can, you know, isolate those out from the pack of foxes. And then over 2 to 3 generations, you will have a domesticated fox, which you would call a dog.
A very short time frame.
In a very short time frame. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what caused that? Well, you know, there are some wolves or some foxes, for example, that by their nature are just more friendly, you know, to humans. Now, recall, before the fall, all animals were friendly towards humans. And it was not unusual, for example, for Eve in the garden. You know, we think today that, you know, you got a talking snake or a talking lizard or whatever. And Eve is talking to this creature.
Nowhere in Genesis does it say Eve screamed.
Yeah, she didn't run away from it as we have today, you know. Who has to take care of the snakes? Who has to take care of the lizards or the roaches or the spiders? Mm-hmm. It's the guy. It's not the woman. You know, so... you know, one of our family stories, but it actually happened a couple of times. We were raising chickens, and we had we have several daughters. We have 5 daughters, for example, and we told one of our daughters to go collect the eggs from the chicken coop. So she's collecting the eggs from the chicken coop. She comes back to the house screaming, because there was a rat snake in the chicken coop, and it was, you know, swallowing the eggs whole, and that scared her a little bit.
That scared me too.
I'm never going back there. I'm never going back. So, you know, some time passed. I took care of the snake and, you know, put it back in the back part of the property, and then sometime later, she got up enough nerve to go collect the eggs, because the snake was taken care of, and lo and behold, there's another snake in the chicken coop, and that kind of clinched it. She will never collect eggs again.
That'd do it. Yep, that'll do it. Well, so we've learned that animals can adapt to environmental niches and do so quickly, and that it's a result of changes in the DNA. You said the expression of the DNA. The DNA they've had all along starts acting slightly differently to help them survive in the new environment. And that evolutionists are claiming that as fast evolution, just another aspect, kind of a subcategory of regular evolution, which supposedly takes eons. And that seems to be somewhat contradictory, doesn't it?
Well, it does, especially when the evolutionists were calling this particular theory that the creationists had, or this idea, I should say, that the creationists had, that organisms have the ability to change, you know, rapidly change based on their environment. And they were laughing at that. But now they're adopting it. Oh, how is that possible when their own theory states that these changes that we see, take eons of time, and we're talking about geological time here. We're not talking about, you know, a couple of generations. We're talking about, thousands and thousands of generations. So any experiments that the evolutionists have done to try to speed up the, let's say, mutations in a particular organism, in the fruit fly is a example of this, hundreds of thousands of generations, you know, because fruit flies breed quickly, they've done in the laboratory, and not one mutation added a different characteristic other than fruit flies without wings, flute flies with curled wings, fruit flies that couldn't fly, fruit flies that, you know.
In other words, the best they've been able to do is to cripple an animal.
To damage what was already there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, is there... go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no. That's pretty much...
If you mess with perfection, the only thing that can result is something lesser than perfect, something less than perfect.
Right, and that's what we see today, and of course the theory of devolution is what's going on, and not the theory of evolution. In other words, more information's not being added, less evolution is...
David, there it is again, Dr. Don's theory of devolution. It comes up all the time.
You got to publish this. This is, I mean, if you don't publish this pretty soon, I'm gonna go out. Maybe I'll have time to get a doctorate myself, and I'll publish it.
Go, there you go.
Quick,
another
quick.
One of them. Yeah, another quick. One of my ideas stolen.
quick before somebody else steals it. I wonder, and you know, and I imagine there's no way to know this. Maybe there is. Is there a list of evolution minded scientists or, you know, archaeologists or anthropologists or whatever? Is there some great big long list of those? I guess, yeah, there would be an association, but would you be able to compare the number of people who have dropped off the list, who have said, now this evolution thing doesn't work anymore? I mean, it's not even a good theory. It seems like a good theory, but it would be interesting to see if there are people out there that are changing their minds.
There are a lot of folks, you know, changing their minds. Of course, this doesn't get talked about in the press, but they come around at least to the point that saying, you know, I don't know how all this happened, but I know this, what I'm looking at is design. Mm. And so there's got to be a great designer somewhere. You know, several years ago, the term intelligent design came about because the evidence is so strong for everything that we see around us being designed and not being evolved through random chance or even being pressured to evolve, as one would, you know, based on this article, you would suggest, the evolutionists are suggesting, this pressure is happening rapidly as opposed to slowly as they originally thought. There are many, many scientists in many different fields that are coming to this conclusion, whether it be in astronomy, whether it be in biology or chemistry or biochemistry or, you know, a whole bunch of different fields that are coming to the correct conclusion that there is a great designer who designed it all.
And if you're interested in researching that a little bit, David, or anybody listening, one place to go is the book, The Case for a Creator, Lee Strobel's book. He interviews a number of scientists who have changed their thinking dramatically. Another place you can go is Creation Moments, the Creation Moments website, which is creationmoments.com. And by the way, there's a beautiful new website being developed for them. But you can still go there now and find a wealth of resources that presents the scientific information that explains biblical creation and how the Bible story and the science are actually easily reconciled. And one supports the other. And it's a beautiful story. And you can find out much more at creationmoments.com. I urge you to visit the website. You can link to it from our website. If you're listening at brokenroadradio.com this morning, there's a link just on the right-hand side of the homepage there to Creation Moments. And see what they have to offer. You'll find videos and DVDs and books and as I say, just a wealth of resources for your own personal study or maybe for your church library. So there's an idea, too. Don Clark, again, biochemist, member of the board at Creation Moments. We're so thankful that you stopped by this morning and explained epigenetics to us. And David, you now have a new word that you can you use that in a sentence? You can own that word now.
Epigenetics is what we talked about this morning.
Very good.
How's that?
Okay. That's your, it's yours. It, you got it. It's
yours. All right.
Don, thanks so much. We'll see you next week, okay?
Okay, very good, folks, and you'll try to stay warm.
We'll do it. Yeah. Well, we're gonna see 36 tomorrow, I think.
Yow.
So we're gonna throw off our coats, run outside, and yell Yahoo! We'll do that.
Yeah. Well, it's been in the 70s here, so.
I didn't need to hear that. Take care, Don.
Okay. See you, Don.
So long.